this period is an exploration of happiness. There's the confirmation. The inner inquiry, exploration of happiness, requires from us inner work, the understanding of the profound significance of the heart, of feelings, emotions, and the various movements of the inner life, and the direction that these movements within take us. It is important and valuable to be able to distinguish both in feelings and intentions the differences between pleasure and happiness. And it's terribly easy and frequent for us as men and women of the earth to confuse the two together. And the consequence of that is we sometimes think and imagine that pleasure is the substitute for happiness. It's frequently at the cost of happiness. And I'll try to explain a little bit what I mean by this. You and I well know, possibly up to 2,000 advertisements in every day, from our streets, from the radio, from our phones, from television, from the media, there is an assault upon our senses, primarily eyes and ears, to pursue pleasure, the maximization of pleasure. And this message, which is a rather vulgar form of propaganda, is used to impact upon our eyes and ears, to stimulate our sensitivities as human beings, to drive and make us want something. It employs psychologists, sociologists, artists, and a whole network of people who, sadly and unfortunately, are caught in a system which is to stimulate desire to want to have for me and myself. It's so relentless, this message. It's generated out to all of us so frequently, including our equally precious and vulnerable children, that it gives an impression in life, and it's a obscene impression. It gives the impression of life in life that I, the human being, is only valid and worthwhile by what I have achieved, what I have got, and by what I own. And the more that I have, the more that I've got, the more successful I feel I am to myself and to others. It's a lie. It's mythology. It's a mental sickness. And it doesn't bring happiness. It is much more likely in this force of the wanting for more to maximize pleasure to bring insecurity, a lack of self-worth, a disconnection from others, and a feeling, no matter how much one has got, one has not got enough, that there is always more to get. And it's rather sad to see in the marketplaces people, mostly men, of my age, it's even more sad, wheeling and dealing in the markets for even more than they've got already. It's a pathology. It's a contemporary mental sickness. And to end up with one's life in the pursuit of all of this, and to think this is what life is about, this is the real. It's not quite true, but I rather smiled. You probably heard of Brad Pitt. I can't think of anything because I don't go and watch Hollywood films because they work like a coma on me. And Brad Pitt said once, he said, didn't say this, but he said, the Buddha said, to be rich, famous, and handsome is bad karma. Very good point. In the elevation of desire, in the stimulation of it inside of the human being, sadly, we have created gods out of the rich and the famous, the handsome, the beautiful, the powerful. They have become our gods. And we get the idea that in that small world, behind those electric fences and those guard dogs and all that money and the fear of going out on the streets, that somewhere is some symbol of something successful. It's a failed life. Life is, in my view, has gone off in the completely wrong direction. And we as human beings on this earth were terribly, terribly vulnerable to being impressed with it all, instead of seeing the utter futility of it when death is just around the corner. So it's going to take some work inside of ourselves. And then we look, it's all grim news at the moment, but hang in. When we look at our own small lives, so far, hopefully, and thank God if there is one, we're not caught up in all of that world I just referred to. And some of those in that world, because time to time I meet with them, are also, to their credit, not caught up in it either. They have deeper values than what appears. But then we have to look at our daily life. And truth, which is the great resource for us, has a very close companion, a close sister and brother. It is called honesty. And honesty is the willingness of ourselves to look carefully at ourselves and to ask ourselves, what do I want? What is it essentially that is moving me? Moving me means in the mind is one movement. In speech, what do I talk about? Two. Three, doing, what do I do with the body? Where do I go? What do I do? What is moving me? What is it that I want? Where am I going? What are the priorities? And once you and I take a little time for some reflection on the wanting mode, the honesty then, at this moment in time, this point in time, starts to come in. And then I have to look. None of this is easy, but it's what truth is about. It's not a metaphysic truth. It's about the experience. I have to look in three considerations. One is the intention. Do I put my hand on my heart and say, my God, I spend far too much time in the material world. The shopping malls, which for some of us are the nearest equivalent to a hell realm, the shopping mall is the nearest equivalent to the hell realms. It's a slight exaggeration, but you know what I mean. I go to the shopping mall, I have to say, briefly. And so sometimes I have to be honest. Is my thought, which is the criteria, the measurement, because that's what thought does, is my thought spending far too much time involved in material matters? And I'm going to be down to earth, please. I'm not a spiritual romantic. Hang in. Is my thought spending far too much time in the material world? And what's the material world? Is it spending so much time in wanting to get what I see, which is the movement from the inner to the outer to have and possess and take for myself? And that ability to do that definitely gives pleasure. What am I dressed in today? All right. a beloved ex, he very kindly gave me this shirt some months ago for my birthday. £2.50 in the charity shop in Totnes High Street. I thoroughly recommend Totnes High Street's charity shop. The sports shop, because I go down to the gym. I'm in the religion of gymism, and etc. There is definitely, I'm happy to find for £2.50, 20 shekels, whatever, this waistcoat. It's, as my grandson said, it's cool. And if he said it's cool, it's cool. Yeah. So I get the pleasure from the event, unquestionably. Yesterday evening, Sophie and Taha and I, we went out to a meal. We were hungry. And after a lovely exchange yesterday evening on death, afterwards, I felt incredibly hungry, and we went out for the sharing and the openness, and it was heart-touching, and I had tears in my eyes, and others as well. And we were hungry, so we went out to eat. Another lovely meal, and it was real pleasure, and I have to say, an excellent glass of Israeli red wine from Galilee. I have to say, it was in the 4.5 five-star category. There. And it genuinely gives a pleasure. Of course, being Tel Aviv, you can't have pleasure without pain. And and the pain was, we came back at midnight, 45 minutes looking for a space to put the car. I mean, talk about heaven to hell. Driving around the streets looking for somewhere, and in the end, parking it illegally and having to get up early in the morning. You know. God, really makes me happy. I go to London sometimes. Anyway, sorry about that. So there is, through the eyes, a beloved sweetheart, Leonard Cohen, has a new album out this week. I hear rumors I might get one as a present. And I listen to the first song that the iPhone or whatever it is released, and he's in. Just listen to the first three lines. He's in good form. He's 80 tomorrow. And he's in good form. In 10 years, I'm in the same form, I'll be happy. But he's a meditator, so we should expect him. There. It's pleasure. Pleasure to listen to Leonard. I love him to bits. So, pleasure comes. It may come because I go to the mall. It may come for a meal. It may come for listening to the music. Still back to the core question. Is this my life? Is this all I do? Am I exaggerating this? Am I thinking too much about this? Am I thinking of the holy communion towards this, which is called money? Is money a priority? If it is, I will never have enough. If I've exaggerated the place of money in life, there will never be enough. If I'm a millionaire, I would be comparing myself with those who have 2 million. And if I've got 2 million, I'd be comparing myself with those who've got 4 million. There is never enough, because desire cannot be satisfied through more desire. The desire may be fulfilled in the moment. I get what I want. That getting what one wants is not happiness. It is the relief from the desire in that moment. I call it happiness, but no, I really, really wanted that. I really, really wanted him. I really, really wanted her. I really wanted this job. God, I feel so happy. It's not happiness. It's just that there is a relief from this desire of what I wanted. And the relief is gone. This has become happiness. And I get some relief. I'm a smoker. All I want is a fag. I want a joint. I want to take a smoke. Once I've got the combination of that wretched cigarette in my mouth and the matches and the light, and I take it in, it's a relief from the wanting. There is a pleasure in the relief from wanting. Happiness is a different ball game altogether. It's a totally different part to live in, which we'll come to. So I'm asking myself some deep questions. I'm a human being. It's the great privilege that I have. Nobody can stop me from asking questions. And my question is, to come back to this one, is there an exaggerated place on the material world? Money, things, ownership and possession. It has a place. One has to be mindful and skillful in the money area, for sure. In the application of our mindfulness and attention, all of the senses, as was mentioned, genuinely, the pleasures can come. The enjoyments can come. But even our beloved scientists keep reminding us that the material world, the cellular world, the DNA world, the particles world, the formations world, what I see, hear, smell, taste and touch, this constitutes in the universe called, it's 4% of what is present. Poor beloved scientists don't know what to call the rest. So they can't get away from the word matter, so they call it dark matter. Because they don't know what else. They're mad about matter. Mad hatters they are. So, if the universe is 4% the material world, shall we say, could we live with 4% of focus and interest and priority? Well, let's be generous, 5%. So, only to say, if I get some balance with all of that, I don't exaggerate the place of the material world. I learn to be content with what I have. Could it be that generates a space for another kind of exploration, which love enters into it. Happiness enters into it. In England, by the way, those of you who have been to England, if there is a crisis at home, the first thing that's generally is said is, put the kettle on and have a cup of tea. Having a cup of tea. It's not yet a crisis in the talking, but hang in. Sometimes when we look at this mad world, you know, sometimes beautifully mad and sometimes maddingly mad. My darling daughter, who I absolutely loved a bit, got married last month. And which was rather odd. For one reason is her father, moi, has never been married. Her mother has never been married. We live about 10 minutes walk away from each other. The word marriage never got mentioned at home at all. And then my daughter decides she wants to get married. I was asking myself, what did I do wrong? You know? And it's so, talk about ownership and possession, this marriage phenomena. It's so patriarchal, it made me, you know, the poor feminist, squirm. So her good man, her good partner, Dean, he rings me up a few months ago, and he is a great guy. He's Caribbean. My daughter only likes Caribbean men because she's cool. She's just think white guys are hopeless. So, you know. Anyway, wouldn't disagree for a moment. And so he rings me up and he said, Christopher, he said, I'd like to have your daughter's hand in marriage. So I asked the obvious question, and the Dharma teacher, which hand? Left hand? Right hand? What about the rest? He said, of course, the whole, I'd love her to bits. Yeah. So I gave him a health warning. I said, look, the word marriage has never been mentioned in our house. I can't ever remember. It's two syllables. I had to look it up in the dictionary. So I said, she might say yes. I know she loves you to bits. She might say no, because it's not her thing. It wasn't her mother and father's thing. And it's not her thing. Or she might say, I don't know, and ask me in 10 years. Or 10 weeks, or whatever. So anyway, she said yes. So I said to him, look, it seems to be very patriarchal, because poor mother is excluded, and the father gives her away. So the father has her. He's the owner. He's got her. And now he's giving her over to another man. So I said, look, it's patriarchal. I own. And now she says, yes, I give her over to you. My possession, I give it over to you. So I said to him, the obvious thing, will you be paying me by cash or credit card? Well, the system's mad, and madness confirms the system. So sometimes in the ordinary and the everyday things of... The wedding was absolutely cool, man. It was brilliant there. And then the other thing he said to me, he said... you know, he's a Caribbean guy, and he said to me, I've already asked Kai, that's Nishauna's son, by a previous lover. I've already asked Nishauna's son. And I said to him, you asked the son? I said, he's not the father of Nishauna. I'm the father. I said, are you confused or something? You know, asking the son, mother's hand in marriage. He was smoking weed or something like this. And so Kai, my grandson, this is true. She got married in the church. It's the first time in her entire life she's been in a church. But now she wants to get married in a church. So father and her son walked her up the aisle. It's eccentric. Both of us take her up the aisle. And then the priest says to me, turns to me in his ceremony, and he said, "Are you willing to give your daughter away?" Well, I suppose so. And then he asked him, the bridegroom, "Are you willing to take her?" Yeah. I mean, come on, this is the 21st century, it's not 5th century. So sometimes, just to look, I'm just coming to the point, long story, but coming to the point, get off my chest, really. But sometimes we don't realize how much idea of ownership and possession captures the imagination that we are caught in. That's all. And it's worthwhile, women and men, to look carefully into this dynamic, because possession and ownership will mean fear and anxiety and insecurity. Possession and ownership carries its shadow of insecurity and fear. And it's a great challenge for us as a human being to recognize the ordinary and the everydays of life. To be able to say, "Oh, this is my shirt, this is my trousers, this is my watch, this is my home, etc." But with the view that goes with it, can I hold, this is the critical, the view rather lightly? I go along with the social agreements. This is mine, that is yours, with all the respect. But knowing that no matter what I have and who I have, there is no guarantee of continuity. And my goodness me, we listened to some warm and beautiful and profound stories last night, and every word that was said was a real reminder to all of us that that which we love so dearly, which we call my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife, rightly and appropriately so, but it doesn't give us an assurance of continuity. No matter how much strong the love, other factors take place in which, in this case, a cancer comes, and the life of a beautiful human being has passed from our life, our own child, our own partner, whatever. And we have to therefore live with the language of I and my, this is mine and she or he is yours. Live with that, but somewhere in the deep of the being, understand that there is no real possession and ownership. And if we hold to that, the suffering, the conflict, the wars, the confusions must arise. When coming to happiness, the various kinds of happiness, and it's part of the exploration and the wonder of life that the expanse of happiness, one of its clearest and most precious confirmations, is that happiness, this is the important line here, happiness reveals and shows itself most obviously and clearly in that experience which I cannot have and own, which I cannot buy, I cannot go out and get. And this happiness needs to be a daily reflection experience confirmation of in the consciousness. I walk out, walk outside, or in here, and you and I, we see beauty. We see the flowers of the day. We see the acts of love and generosity. We feel happy that Tovana has beautifully organized these hours that we have together. We see the small gestures of life taking place. The sky above and the earth below. And the myriad number of things. And the thought doesn't arise of possession and ownership of. The happiness is there. We feel the happiness. We feel the happiness of a shared conversation with another. We feel the happiness of the wonder and the beauty of the day, of the small details of life which touch a place inside of us. This happiness, literally and metaphorically, is priceless. You cannot go and get it. You won't find it in the supermarket. And this happiness, we have our eyes and ears and nose and tongue, and the dear Buddha, who I'm a huge fan of, pointed out, if a person cuts out all the pleasure, cuts it out, you know, some of these pathological Buddhist monks do this, they cut out all the pleasure, the end result, the heart will become dry. They, or Advaitins, or Vedantins, whatever, will see the world as an illusion. So the heart's been starved, cut out the pleasure, or pleasure is wanting, it's desire, it's problematic, cut it out. And the Buddha was familiar with that view. It was in the world of the yogis at the time, there. And in contrast to this, the teachings clearly and explicitly and encourage us to develop the senses, to open the eyes to seeing, not cut him out. He said, if cutting out seeing and hearing was problematic, if it was problematic, he said, better to be born blind than deaf. He said, no, we cultivate our practice, seeing and hearing, smelling and tasting and touching there. In that, and particularly as I mentioned, in that which comes to us, which is happiness, which is not to be made a possession of. Beautiful. And that happiness then begins to replace the desire for more and more. Why would I keep wanting more when there is so much already to be happy about? And this happiness gets deeper inside the being. Some of you know from Tovana, which I travel around this little planet of ours quite regularly. And sometimes it's knowledge which gives happiness. And when I'm overseas, the situation of Israel is obviously a constant reference point. In the very, very painful times, such as recently, and when it's a little bit more quiet, and so forth. And people regularly ask me about the practitioners, the yogis, the Dharma wallahs, Kovana, when I'm in other parts of the world. And this is a small illustration of the importance of happiness. And the two things which bring me happiness, and which I share with others, one is the general sense and feeling from the seniors, that means the teachers, some who are in the hall here now, and others in the Dharma, is a real concern to find ways and skillful ways and means to bridge this terrible divide between the Israeli community, Israeli country, and its neighbors, and the divide within Israel between Palestinian Israelis, or Arab Israelis as you call them, and the Jewish community. And because steps are taken in that regard, because there is some work for the bridging taking place, it might be small, it might be relatively insignificant, it's not the thing. But there's a happiness in knowing that there are thoughtful people, that Tovana is not a navel-gazing club. It has a vision. It's concerned with suffering. It's taking steps there. And therefore it says the love and the friendship matter more than political ideologies of any side. And I think that is precious. And the other, and it brings me happiness, and it's a happiness for me to be able to share this with the outside world. And the second one, and just as important for me as well, Tovana, as you know, as a network, it runs its programs at Eindhoven and elsewhere on donation. It's a phenomenal message. It's a rare message that's going out, working with the Dharma there. And I hear voices and articles that the tradition of trust, of love, of donation is under threat. There is more and more in the Buddhist world payment for services model, which is fine, which we use in the West a lot. And when Tovana started and many discussions, and I, of course, one of those very keen on this, some of the beloved Israeli friends, you've been coming to Israel long enough, it won't work. It won't work here. People will think it's just some shekels for a good cappuccino or something. They won't work here. People just like it clear. You go, you pay, you come home, etc. So no, we've got to trust. And that trust has confirmed itself. It must be more than 10 years now, I think. Was it wrong? Yeah. It's around 10 years that it's been working. We said, look, we'll try on the donations, year by year. If it doesn't work, all right. When people come, they pay for the running costs, etc. It's these acts of generosity and acts of love and acts of concern which take place. So knowing of this, this knowing brings happiness. It is happiness. Happiness to know that such people are committed. It, such happiness in our tears yesterday evening to listen to these extraordinary stories of how is it that people dying from cancer, the body riddled with cancer, having to live day by day, never knowing if they wake up in the morning or whatever, having to endure so much. And somehow, in the depth of the being, finding ways and means to serve others, to start programs for others, to write a book, to keep blogs, to listen to people, to check with how other people are, to go traveling to different parts of the world with their cancer. Where does that power come from? One would think they just want to lie in bed and be looked after morning, noon and night. Something moves there. And when you and I hear first-hand experiences of what people do, one just feels awe, feels the wonder of it, the privilege of listening to such stories. One feels happy to be alive and to have the honour to listen to people's first-hand account of what they experience. So the Dharma teachings say, this happiness, these happinesses, this is precious. This is priceless. And if you and I, in our daily life, every day, can experience and recognize all these moments of happiness from within, from what we know, from what we see and hear, if we can experience all of those happinesses, the number of pilgrimages to the shopping mall will go down there. The number of thoughts about what I need and must have and I can't live without will go down there. People may come into our life and we're happy and experience that joy and connection with them. And the person, she or he or they, may move on from our life. Their right and their privilege and or the circumstance. And we still can work with that, feel the sadnesses that may go with that. But the happinesses and the renewal will begin to come back in as well. So I therefore say, yes, there are the pleasures of life. I listed to you, mentioned to you a few of my own. The happinesses of life are freely available. Let's really remember the free availability of so many happinesses. There. If we get that balance right, we provide a wonderful service for ourselves and each other, and we ensure the continuity of human life on Earth. Because with 7 billion of us on this earth, there are simply not enough resources left to satisfy the desires of human beings. There is simply not enough. And we need a revolution, a radical change in vision, to bring happiness to life, the freely available happinesses, which are countless, so that we get a balanced perspective on the material world. Thank you. Time is 1:20. So let's have 3 or 4 minute break, stretch the legs, and a little time for some question and answers. No? Anybody know the timetable?
Lunch break.
Eh? Lunch break now. Om.
Lunch break.
In 10 minutes. Yeah. All right. So, now that you're still here. So, it's lunch break in 10 minutes. If any responses, anything you'd like to add or subtract, and then at 10... In 10 minutes' time, we'll start some lunch. Yes, please. Yes.
Christopher Dubert and happiness.
You spoke of happiness.
Yeah.
ראיתי דברים בחיים לפי השיער של אלוהים.
During my lifetime, yes. I
can see it by my hand. ראיתי בהודו, ראיתי בן אדם שמצא חתיכת קרטון לישון עליו בלילה. וראיתי את השמחה שלו.
And I saw his joy.
ואני שוב חוזרת למזרח התיכון
ולישראל.
ואני שואלת, איך אני יכולה למצוא אושר כשאני רואה את הצד השני, כמו שקרה בצוק איתן, שגם קרטון אי אפשר למצוא, כי הבית נפל על הראש. אני לא יכולה להאמין שהם ימצאו את האושר, וגם לא אני.
The response was a very important one, that sometimes there is knowledge and sometimes experience of terrible suffering for the other. And the reference is some of the demolitions and the loss of life in Gaza recently. In the view of this, of course, the feeling response in such events, as well as the deaths here as well, of happiness obviously would not be the appropriate response. The natural response, of course, to suffering, whether intentional to cause it, whether by accident or circumstances, is to feel the sadness there. Sadness would be the natural response to empathy where they're suffering, which transcends the vested interests of the nation state or the political organization here, or in this case Gaza. The sadness of life, of these experiences, has the potential to, and it's not easy, to empower some action, to keep the voice alive. Even if it's a very much a minority voice, in which the vision in the voice, in some way or other, is bridging the divide. That one's heart is saying, this cannot go on like this. These pauses, killings, maimings, and destruction, pauses, cannot go on like this. It's intolerable for everybody. That voice will come out of the sadness, it will come out of the concern for suffering. It has nothing to do with the politics of the left, right, or center, because that's the problem and not the cure. And it isn't easy if the voice is small, because the voices of division are strong. They have to be, they're strong. And what happens, and if I may say, speaking personally here, coming to Israel for more than 20 years, having listened to the inner life of literally thousands and thousands of Israelis, the vulnerability is, though I hear many voices like yours, many voices of some sadness of what's happened to us, I've in England, and in France, and in Germany, I've been listening to voices, and in this case, of Jewish voices, who had been talking to me in the coffee shop, on a retreat, on a train or whatever, and are crying, tears pouring out of them, and asking a kind of core question of, what's happened to us? Asked the Jewish community. Where have we gone wrong? How has it got to so much suffering for us and for our neighbors? What's happening to us? And they're not living here or just coming to see family. And the stress inside of them. And I hear similar voices when I come here as well. So something from the sadness mustn't, if it gets heavy, it becomes despair. And the despair becomes a kind of paralysis. And the voice which is the deadly voice of all is, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing I can do. That to me is a statement of utter depression. Understandable. But it's our undertaking, it's our questioning to see, to keep the voice alive. The voice of love, of compassion, of service, of concern, the voice which will change things and get everybody, as it were, back on track, and with deep respect, and out of that something can emerge. One knows it's not easy, but let's not give in to the voices of depression. The voices of duality, us and them. So it is a genuinely major undertaking. And just finally, just coming back to the happiness for the moment. Extraordinary thing with us as human beings, when we feel empowered, an all major change in life, which has been worthwhile, has come from small groups of people like ourselves, who say, this cannot go on, something has to change. And though it's very difficult, though we have to weather a lot of blame, and that we're naive, we're romantics, we're lefties, we're lost, we're not living in the real world, we have to weather all this rhetoric, pours out, and I get plenty of it myself, you know, obviously. But in a way, it's kind of staying true to something, there. And in an odd sort of way, there's a happiness in it. There's a happiness in staying true to something, no matter what is said. No matter what our ears have to endure, or our emails, and all the abuse that comes, and the threats that come. That one knows the heart's totally committed to the resolution of suffering. And one's not moving away from it. And there's a mad happiness in it. Finally, one more voice. Lunchtime. Enjoy. Be happy. Interest. Curiosity. Okay. Thank you.